You're listening to the Barry Egan Tapes on News Talk. I'm Barry Egan from the Sunday Independent, and I'm talking about Victoria Mary Clark. Victoria, Merry Christmas. Thanks for coming in.
Are you still allowed to say Merry Christmas, Barry?
Oh, Jesus.
There's got to be another word for it now, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think you meant to
say
happy holidays.
You're not allowed to say a lot of things these days, but we'll talk about that later.
Happy festivities.
Listen, you grew up without your biological father. And in Shane McGowan, of all people, you found stability.
Oh, yeah, of all people.
And security.
That's sort of what do you call that, a paradox? No, it's not a paradox. It doesn't seem to make any sense, does it?
No.
You would think you'd end up with somebody very secure and very, reliable.
But in a lot of ways, Shane gave you that.
Yeah, because I suppose, the thing is, maybe what I was looking for was somebody who was entirely committed and very devoted. And that's what I found.
Primarily because obviously your mother got pregnant when she was 19.
Yeah.
You were going to be put up for adoption. Your grandfather stepped in. And you basically grew up without your biological dad.
Yeah, I didn't even know.
What age were you when you found out?
Because my mum then got married. And I found out when I was around 16 that the birth certificate said father unknown. So it was kind of weird. Why is that?
How did that make you feel?
Curious more than anything else.
Because you were never curious before that Dardis Clark wasn't your dad.
Oh no, I assumed he was. I mean, there was no reason to not, reason to suspect. But, of course, they separated when I was quite small. So I don't know.
Was there a night when, or a day when you, your sister Vanessa and mum drove off?
Yeah, we left in the night time. I remember that. And it wasn't a happy thing. It wasn't we're just going to amicably separate. It wasn't a conscious uncoupling. I think it was pretty dramatic. So
was that the way your childhood was?
There was a certain amount of drama, but then there was a certain amount of freedom, which I think a lot of kids don't have. I remember one of my earliest memories is sitting, playing with the frogs in the well.
Where was the house? Sorry.
Up on Callery Bog in Wicklow. Do you know Callery Bog?
Yeah.
Up near. Do you know where the filling station is underneath the Sugarloaf? So we lived in an old schoolhouse there, and there was a well in the garden. And I had very happy memories of sitting playing with the frogs, but also talking to the fairies that lived behind the house. And I did that every day. Every day I would go out and chat to them and they would talk back, and it was like a world.
What would you talk to them about?
Anything and everything. They were just friends. I found that whole thing to be a big adventure because I suppose I didn't really know anything else. And there was a lot of space, which I liked. We lived on a bog and we weren't restricted in
our
movements.
How was your mother?
How was she? I think she was kind of having, it was a bit of an adventure. She was very young. She had made friends with a lot of what we now call hippies. I suppose we did call them hippies then too. Some of them were English. There were some German ones, some Dutch ones, American ones. And they were very, I suppose, countercultural. They were experimenting with all kinds of things. It was a bit like being in San Francisco,
In Wicklow.
Yeah. So what was missing, I suppose, was the sunshine. But they were trying to be flower children. They were trying to be peace and love, alternative, back to nature, growing the vegetables, growing other things, obviously, as well. But listening to a lot of music, dropping out of society, doing things that are now very hip and living off the grid.
So were you and Vanessa kind of like wild children running around?
I suppose, in a way. But, we had some influences to tame us, which would have been like my grandparents, who would have put us in the bath whenever we went round there, straight in the bath.
And is it true that did your granddad stop you from being put up for adoption?
That's what I was told. Yeah, that he decided it would be much better. I mean, that he wanted to keep me.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
So just take me back to that night when you were 7 or 8 and you're in the car. Where were you driving to?
Oh, we were driving just down the road to my aunt's house, just down the road. So
how long did you stay there for?
I honestly haven't a clue. The way when you're a kid, things seem like they're going on for years, but actually it could have been months. It was probably less than a year.
Yeah.
We were going to the local school in Enniskerry. So luckily we were able to keep going to the same school.
And then your mother met a man called Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, were you resentful of Dave? You didn't want to share your mother with him?
Yeah, I didn't like the idea of her having a partner because I think I wanted her all to myself. And I guess he was also very young and also on the same kind of path, like really into his Indian guru, his meditation, his yoga. You know, he'd come from London. And later, like now, I admire him tremendously because I think the stuff he was doing is so out there. He hitchhiked from London to India across Afghanistan and Pakistan to get to the beach where he lived and met the guru and became a disciple.
Yeah.
And so it's like incredibly cool stuff. It's like the stuff that the Beatles were doing and my parents were doing it. So I'm very proud of them now. But I suppose as a kid, you know, most children want to be really normal and they want to fit in at school and they want to be like the other kids. So I did have that conflict of wanting to be like everyone else, but at the same time really relishing the freedom and the excitement. And I think that's what happened with Shane. I mean, so Shane is not someone who's remotely like anyone else. He's completely unique and he's also completely mental, as we all know. And he lives way outside the norms of society. And so we've lived a very exciting countercultural kind of life. And that's the person I ended up looking for security with.
And what was it with Shane? I mean, when you first met him, there was obviously something, I mean, I'm not trying to turn into Sigmund Freud, but there was something psychological with you that you wanted a father figure and of all the people in the world to find
to
it
pick
with,
that.
With Shane.
Yeah, I know. I don't think I obviously when I first saw him, I didn't see him as a father figure. I saw him as a symbol of freedom and of being your own person, you know, being yourself, like a kind of John Lennon type character.
But what were you like at the time, around the time you met Shane?
I was looking mainly for excitement, glamour, and some kind of identity, because I didn't actually know what I wanted or what I wanted to be. But I left Ireland and went to London really in search of that, you know, in search of the thing that I had seen in magazines and heard on the radio. Definitely more I wanted to be around the cool people, the ones I'd seen in Jackie and in Hot Press. You know, when I first saw Hot Press, I was like, I want to be around these people, or the Melody Maker. Yeah, I wasn't happy to just read about them. I really wanted to be where the action was. And so London to me seemed like the obvious choice. And clothes and fashion were really important to me.
Yeah.
So the way it was very difficult to get cool clothes in Ireland at that time. So getting them in Portobello Road was much easier.
What was London like then? That was, what is it, the mid-80s?
So this would have been, early 80s. Yeah, so 1984.
And where did someone introduce you to Shane?
Yes, my friend, Joe, who was American but lived in Cork. And she had a place in London. And she said, why don't you just come over and stay with me? You know, you'll have a lot more fun. We can go to the markets. And I ended up getting a stall in Camden Market selling secondhand clothes. So we drank in the local pub near where we lived, which was in Temple Fortune, North London, which is a very middle class and quite suburban kind of place. It's not the sort of place you'd expect to see Shane McGowan. But the Tin Whistle Player, Spider, was living next door to the pub. That's it. He lived in a flat just like next door. And so it was him who brought Shane in. And we were just sitting there having a drink and these two came in and I just noticed them straight away because they were so different. And I think it was their swagger. You know, it was, you know, the way cowboys, you know, Clint Eastwood walks into a saloon, there's that kind of swagger and there's that presence and there's the clothes, you know, the black suits, tall, skinny guys with black suits, good looking, even though Shane did have a few missing teeth and sticky out ears, he was still... But yeah, it was mainly the arrogance. And I think that I was
attracted to that?
Yeah, yes. I was attracted to people who believed in themselves or who felt good about themselves or who felt important. I think it was the sense of being important.
Yeah. Did you end up like moving in?
Oh, no, it took like years and years. I went to see their band because I think Spider invited me to see them, and I was really, really blown away because they were so, again, full of themselves. I keep coming back to that. It was just like they were just owning it, absolutely owning it. They weren't even particularly good at what they were doing. So they were playing Irish music.
Was this
before
they became the Pogues?
No, they were the Pogues, but yeah. they were just like in their early stages. Andrew would be standing up, bashing the drum. Cart would be there on the bass, like thumping away, but really pulling some attitude. Like she had short skirts and high heels and she had really long legs anyway. And she was like really good looking. So I was looking at her as much as him. I must say, I found her very attractive. But Shane.
So did Elvis Costello.
Yeah, I guess everyone did.
He married her.
Yeah. But like Shane's presence and his just. He had such a different take on Irish music. It made me completely rethink not just Irish music, but my Irish heritage all round.
And was it falling in love with Shane? Was it like falling in love with a hurricane? How are you going to control this?
Well, it took a long time for me to realise that I was falling in love because I went back to Ireland and actually got another boyfriend who then came to live in London with me. And we began to go to Pogues gigs and just hang out as friends with Shane and Spider. And then one night my boyfriend was away, and I remember this really clearly, and Shane was there. It was my birthday. And his friend said, oh, it's Victoria's birthday. You should kiss her. So he did. And it was at that moment that I realized. So it's like such a Mills and Boone moment.
What age were you?
I was 20.
Yeah.
So we'd known each other for 4 years at that point. And I'd been going to see him and we had just been friends. But there was a moment then when I was like, wow, okay, so you can't go back from that,
yeah.
I think.
And how you couldn't go back, so you went forward.
And so, of course, I still had the boyfriend, and I went out on a date with Shane.
What
to
was
the 100
like?
Club. So Shane took me to the 100 Club. Do you know the 100
yeah.
Club in Oxford Street? But we couldn't get in because Shane had had a fight with the bouncer the previous week, and the bouncer didn't want to let him in, and so Shane was asking him to hit him. He's like, trying to start a fight with him. He's like, go on, hit me. Go on, hit me. And the bouncer was like, fuck off, Shane. I'm not going to hit you. And so they had a verbal and we just couldn't get in. So we had to just go back to Shane's flat, which was one
Maybe it was
room.
All a ruse.
His flat, like Shane
was... What was flats, Shane's flat like?
So it was one room in King's Cross. It wasn't a squat, but it was short life housing. So community housing, I think it was like...
Short life.
You know those, like, yeah, SCH.
Shane soon proved that wrong, didn't he? He'd outlive all of us, but go on.
It was painted dark red, not unlike your studio. It had dark red sheets on the bed, I remember that. He was very kind, polite and gentlemanly. He didn't even want to sit beside me. So he told me to sit on one side of the room and he sat on the other side of the room. And he played me a lot of records.
What was he playing you?
Well, mainly John Coltrane, from what I can remember.
Shane was wooing you with jazz.
John Coltrane yeah. loved
I love John Supreme.
Coltrane. I love Supreme,
yeah.
Exactly. And African Brass, remember that too.
Yeah.
He had a lot of televisions. I think he had about 5 televisions, but they were all like semi-functional, black and white, like from the skip. And he had a cocktail bar which was shaped like a ship.
Was he making you cocktails?
No, we were drinking, I think, Retsina, that Greek white wine, which is pretty rough.
Yeah.
We smoked a lot. We chain smoked. I remember that. And we talked a lot. We talked a lot about Irish poetry because Shane was pretty obsessed with Irish poetry. And he figured that me being from Ireland and having, you know, connection to Austin Clarke, that I would know a lot about Irish poetry, which turned out to be true because I did. And I had actually been writing poetry in Irish as a kid.
Yeah.
And I'd read Undunera and I, you know, so I did, like, we had a shared affinity for Irish poetry. So we talked a lot about poetry and I remember eventually him saying, do you mind if I sit beside you? And I was like, I've been waiting for that for hours for him to sit beside me. So it was really me who got off with him. It was definitely, he didn't initiate it. But once we had got together, we really were inseparable. the attraction was so much more than physical. Although it was very physical, it was also a lot more than physical. You know, we did connect on all the other levels, which I think is unusual. When you first meet somebody, to connect on so many levels, to just feel like you just get each other.
Yeah.
And you really do almost feel like, it felt to me like he was my other half. Like, you know, people say that. They say twin flame. They say, you know, soulmate. I kind of knew
even
that we
when
were
you gonna... found him in bed with other women.
Well, I mean, I had to dump him for a while. Yes, that's true. That was devastating. Later. That came a lot later. But initially, I think I felt I had found the one, I'd found my other half, and that we were now together. And it was our destiny. I did really feel like a destiny thing.
And did you have the chat with Shane? Look, you go on tour a lot. You're a rock star. You drink a lot. You do a lot of other stuff. Are you going to be faithful to me?
No, I didn't have that chat.
Did that feel like an uncool chat to have?
No, because mainly...
You didn't need to have it.
Mainly because he was the one who suggested I go on tour with him. So I had a job in the sock shop in the London Underground selling socks. It wasn't, yeah, so it wasn't like a very exciting, you know, lucrative career. It was pretty basic. It was pretty boring. And Shane said, look, you know, I'm going to be on tour all the time. I find it really hard to be on tour. It's really difficult. It would make it a hell of a lot easier if you would come. And also, you might enjoy it. And I was like, yeah, I actually would. I mean, the idea of traveling around America or Australia or Japan or Europe even, for me, it was tremendously exciting. And it was worth giving up the sock shop.
Yeah.
And it meant, like, as an aspiring writer, it gave me some material because I didn't really have anything to write about in the sock shop. But I did. Once I got on the road with the band, I was writing all the time. So,
what was that like to tour with the Pogues?
Well, it was a bit like Spinal Tap. Have you ever seen Spinal Tap? So Spinal Tap looks tame compared to the Pogues. Spinal Tap is a very realistic film. And I think anyone who's in the music industry who's seen it will tell you that. So, yeah, it was like a bunch of lads having a really good time, you know, staying up all night, drinking, partying, picking up girls, watching porn, doing like everything. Watching a lot of violent films, like more than porn. It was more violent films. They were into things like Once Upon a Time in America. They got a lot of mafia stuff. But yeah, they were very laddish lads and really up for a laugh.
And how were you during all that? Were you drinking a lot?
Absolutely.
Because yeah, we're skipping forward, but in 2000, you and Shane ended up in the Priory.
That is very true. We did. Yeah, I mean, I had started drinking pretty young. I think I'd started drinking when I was about 13 or 14. And I could drink a lot. Like, I could drink Pachin as a child. I could drink a whole bottle of it.
But joking aside, you went in because you were depressed and suicidal and anxious about yourself.
Much later on. Yeah. So we've kind of jumped ahead a huge section. Yeah. The Priory. Yeah. So at that stage, I had been drinking and doing every other drug I could get my hands on, basically. And it wasn't working, and I felt like shit all the time.
Why wasn't it working?
Well, I suppose chemically, you know, it doesn't work. It only works for a while, and then it starts to not work, and your body starts to not.
I didn't mean why wasn't heroin working or whatever
you're taking. Oh, I didn't really do much. No, I tried heroin once or twice. Didn't like it at all. Found that it made me feel really sick, but it also made me itch all over. And it didn't give me a joyful feeling. It gave me more of a feeling of disconnection. So I couldn't understand why people liked it. I found, for me, I preferred the type of drug they give you in hospital. You know, when you're having an operation, don't even know what it's called, but it's pethidine
all
or
right,
something.
Okay.
Yeah, so like if you break your leg or something, they give you this stuff and it feels great. And then when it wears off, you feel really bad.
Well, what were you depressed and suicidal and anxious about?
Mainly, I think, without realizing, I was probably chemically depressed from all the drink and drugs without even knowing. And I was very depressed by the fact that I was not, in my mind, a successful person. My career had not gone anywhere. I had tried to write a book about Nirvana, the band Nirvana.
Which Kurt Cobain loved. Didn't he ring you up and threaten to kill you?
Yeah, Kurt Cobain rang me up, threatened to kill me. Courtney bashed me over the head. The publishers pulled out. So the book was basically squashed, couldn't be published. But my colleague and I, who was writing the book with me, had invested a huge amount of time and energy into doing the book. And we had really kind of like taken, like we'd banked our careers on it. And we were having letters circulated by fax in those days to every single magazine and newspaper on the planet, telling people, editors, to have nothing to do with us, which meant that we just didn't have careers anymore.
And was it also that you just felt like Shane McGowan's girlfriend?
Mm. But if I had been successful with my book, I would have felt like I'd had an independent career of my own that meant something. So being, you know, associated with somebody very successful when you are not successful is very depressing.
But why did you go into the Priory with Shane then?
Because I needed to go somewhere. I had been seeing a counsellor. Actually, at that point, I'd been seeing a counsellor every day and was still feeling suicidal. So, I mean, I was telling her every day, look, I still don't want to live. I just want to die. And she was like, you know, just need to get through it. You just talk through it, whatever. It didn't work. Absolutely.
And you went on a final bender before you went into the Priory.
Yeah, so once Shane had to go to the Priory, I think he was basically told, you know, you can either go there or prison. So he chose the Priory. And I went with him to see what it was like. And I realized that if I could get myself institutionalized, I might have a chance. I don't know why. I just felt the need to have somebody take over.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I wasn't doing any kind of a job of running my own life and I needed someone else to be in charge. Someone who knew what they were doing, really.
And was Shane giving you advice on your life then?
In the sense that he would always tell me that my writing was really good and that it would eventually be recognised and that I shouldn't listen to the people who criticised it. Because at this point I had been sending off novels and screenplays to publishers and getting rejection letters, a lot of them. Yeah. And so every time I got another rejection letter, it was another, you know,
but
it
wasn't
added
there something at a deeper level? Because you did the Hoffman process, which is like, is it a couple of weeks of therapy? It's more or less 7 years mashed into 2 weeks. And in that, you learned, you put yourself back in your mother's shoes. She was 19, she got pregnant, she was terrified.
Mm-hmm.
You were going to be put up for adoption. You imagine what it'd been like for you if that was you?
Mm. So that happened after the Priory. And I think the Priory was a stepping stone towards that. Because in the Priory, you do a lot of talking in groups. And you get to hear everyone else's story and you get to hear what everyone else is feeling.
Yeah.
And so, like, there were people in there who were aristocrats and there were people in there who were, you know, absolutely the opposite, like really broke. But all of them said exactly the same thing in the group therapy, which is they never felt good enough. And that was the core reason they all wanted to kill themselves. So having learned that, I realized that this isn't just me. It's a thing. It's a recognized syndrome. People have it no matter where they come from, no matter how successful they are. So some of them were already very successful, perhaps in business, still saying they wanted to kill themselves, still not feeling good enough. So I did realize that maybe success isn't the answer.
Was the answer, in some sense, when you met your dad, finally?
No, it was, you know, obviously I hoped that that was going to be the answer. I hoped that I would meet this person, that he would say, gosh, Victoria, you know, I've missed you this whole time. You have now made my life complete. I'm here for you now.
And Cinderella.
Going to look after you. Live happily, like the prince on the white horse, whatever. But it was pretty much the opposite. It was like meeting a very awkward stranger who you really don't seem to have anything in common with. You're both nervous of each other. You know, you don't know what to expect or you don't know what you're going to get from each other. And it didn't develop into a father-daughter relationship. It developed into, you know, we kind of chatted and got to know each other a bit, but it definitely wasn't going to turn into that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
So it was a big disappointment and it probably added to the depression in that, you know, here's another thing that's not going to work out.
Obviously it couldn't have been easy sometimes with Shane. I'm just thinking of, like, was it 2004? Shane said that his addiction to heroin ruined the only relationship with the only woman he ever loved, i.e. you.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
when you broke up, it was like a living hell. It was worse than trying to come off heroin.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
Well, at that point, we had been apart. So we broke up for a while after the Priory, a couple of years. It was that was hell. Yeah, it was definitely hell. It was much, much worse for me than anything I'd been through while I was with him. Because I think the loneliness was the worst part.
For him and for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't realize that he felt as lonely as I felt because I was living alone in a bedsit.
In here. London?
Oh. No, here. I moved to Dublin, left him. And I felt, you know, that it was necessary to leave and to try to make a life for myself.
And so, did you have friends saying to you, look, this is not good for your self-esteem to be going through this and then getting back with him all the time? Try and work it out or stay apart forever?
I don't think, I'm not sure if anyone ever did say that, Barry. It's funny, isn't it? No, people used to say kind of the opposite. So they weren't really friends, I suppose, in a way. A lot of them said, oh no, he needs you. You have to be with him.
Did
he
you
loves
need,
you really.
Yeah.
You must get back together with him. So a lot of people put enormous amounts of pressure on me to get back together with him every time I broke up with him. And the pressure would come from everyone.
But there was one time, didn't Sinead report,
Sinead O'Connor.
Reported Shane to the police for doing heroin.
She did. I think she did it for me because she felt that it was necessary. She thought it might make him stop or at least rethink. She knew I wasn't going to be able to do it.
Was there ever a final, what was the final straw or is there a final straw?
Is there a final straw? I think for him, the final straw was being apart from me, but also realizing that heroin hadn't done what he wanted it to do and wasn't going to do it for him. And he had to come to that realization by himself.
Yeah.
Somehow. And he did. I mean, it was actually very religious, I think. His moment, his epiphany with heroin was quite religious because he is very religious.
Yeah.
So
and
he
quite
had
a very
like,
sensitive guy.
Yeah, but also deeply religious. And he had a spiritual epiphany, literally. And I think the Holy Spirit came to him in the form of Finbar Fury. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. and he got saved.
So at what point did you decide, look, Shane, we've been together over 30 years. Let's get married.
This would have been probably about 10 years ago that we decided this. At least 10 years ago.
It's a pretty long engagement.
Maybe 11 years. Yeah, but like neither of us liked the idea of a fussy wedding. So, and it seemed almost inevitable that that's what it would be in this country because there's so, you know, that's how weddings are here. So it was only when I, for some reason, Googled other places to get married. I just thought, hey, maybe we should just get married somewhere else. Elope, you know what I mean? Go to Bali or somewhere. So I looked and found Copenhagen. And I thought, wow, Copenhagen's great. It's a beautiful city. I've been there a lot. Love it. I don't know anyone there. That's really good because no one I know there can come to the wedding.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to get to. So like if we, you know, obviously you're going to have to bring a few people, maybe like close family. So it's easy for them to get to, but at the same time, it's distant enough.
So what's it like? What's your Christmas like? Are you sitting around doing the Telegraph together?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You do crosswords.
Yeah, we went through a phase of doing the Daily Telegraph crossword together, which I think was really cute because I think most people's perception, especially of Shane, is that, you know, that he's probably, I don't know, like not that kind of guy. I don't even know what to say that perception is, but this kind of heavy drinking, like almost moronic character. It's like a Podge and Rodge type character or something. You know what I mean? He's kind of a made up character,
but
which isn't really real.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't be with him for over 30 years if he was like that.
No, definitely not. No, he's a deep thinker and he's very quiet and very introverted.
So you're sitting up in bed and like discussing Dostoevsky?
We certainly have done plenty of that. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's the kind of guy, he's so intelligent that there is very little that you couldn't have a conversation with him about. And I suppose we are lucky in that we have very similar interests still. And the heroin thing, like I began to realize after having gone through that sense of real, real loneliness and devastation that even though I don't like heroin itself, I could see why somebody would feel the need to medicate in that situation.
Yeah.
So I began to really sympathize and understand. And accept, you know, this people medicate for a reason. They're not doing it to get at their families. They're not doing it to be bad people. They're doing it because they really feel bad in themselves.
What were you medicating for?
Well, I felt bad about life.
And you feel better now?
I feel a lot better now. And
good.
Like you mentioned, the Hoffman process, that was an enormous transformation for me to do that process. It was amazing.
Brilliant. Listen, yeah. Victoria, thanks so much for coming
We've covered
in.
A lot of
We've
stuff, haven't we, Barry?
Listen, Merry Christmas. And we won't
Don't
even...
say Merry Christmas.
Sorry. What do you want me to say? Happy Hanukkah.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Listen, will you give Shane our love?
I will.
And if you want some turkey, you know where we are.
You know we don't eat turkey. But yeah, vegan turkey.
Oh, sorry. Fair enough.
It's better for you.